You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
All right, time now to begin the reading of the Boston Globe for this Tuesday, the 14th of July, 2026, and we say hello to Liza.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to be reading by myself today. Pete is doing something else. So I'm going to start with an article from the front page of today's Globe. Man fatally shot in Maine during an ICE operation. Circumstances of shooting in Biddeford unclear. Angry protests spread as a recent spate of violence mars immigrant crackdown. An ICE agent shot and killed a man Monday morning while attempting to serve a deportation order in this small coastal city, authorities said, sparking angry protests over the latest fatal encounter in the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. The circumstances of the shooting remained unclear Monday night. The state attorney's general's office said the victim allegedly attempted to flee in a vehicle in the direction of the officer and was fatally shot. However, Senator Angus King's office said he was told by Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen that the victim was not the target of the immigration operation. According to the Department of Homeland Security, its agents around 7 a.m. were conducting targeted surveillance on the last known address of an illegal alien with a final order of removal. An illegal alien departed the residence in a vehicle, a department spokesman told the Globe. ICE law enforcement attempted to conduct a vehicle stop. The vehicle attempted to flee the scene and, fearing for public safety, an officer discharged his weapon. State officials did not identify the victim or the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent who shot him, although they said the agent had been placed on administrative leave. A pair of immigrant advocacy groups in Maine identified the victim in a news release as a 26-year-old Colombian and said he had been authorized to work in the United States. Officials with the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition and Presente Maine said they are devastated and outraged by the shooting. The victim lived with his partner and young child and had a food delivery job, according to neighbors. We're also hearing that the victim's family may have witnessed the incident, including a 3-year-old child, Representative Shelley Pingree wrote on Facebook. This horrific incident must be investigated thoroughly, transparently, and with Maine officials involved in every step of the way. Witness said that the front windshield of the victim's car had been punctured by at least 4 bullet holes. Speaking at a news conference in Portland, King said he had been told by Mullen that the victim, who had been ordered removed from the country, allegedly had weaponized his vehicle before he was shot. Hours later, however, a spokesman for King said the senator was informed by Mullen that the victim was not the target of the warrant. King, an independent, said officers were not wearing body cameras when the shooting occurred. He called for a full, transparent, and open investigation that includes state and local authorities. The Boston Office of Homeland Security Inspector General has taken over the investigation of the shooting in cooperation with the FBI, officials said. Residents said the shooting occurred amid a spike in ICE activity in Biddeford in recent weeks, and it followed the agency's controversial January crackdown in Maine, called Operation Catch of the Day, in which hundreds of immigrants were detained. King's call for a transparent probe was echoed by Senator Susan Collins, Governor Janet Mills, and other Maine lawmakers. Collins, a Republican who is up for re-election, released a statement on social media saying that the shooting requires a full and impartial investigation. As details emerged, protesters who tie Collins to President Trump's immigration crackdown gathered outside her Biddeford office chanting, "Vote her out." The shooting is the 27th by ICE agents using lethal rounds since March 2025, according to data collected by the Gun Violence Data Hub. It also is the 8th fatal shooting by ICE agents, the 2nd within a week, and the 1st documented ICE shooting incident in Maine. On July 7th, a Mexican construction worker and father of three who lived in the country for more than 30 years without legal status was shot dead as officers pursued his van in Houston. In Biddeford, a city of 22,000 people, about 20 miles north of Portland, the sound of gunshots in the street Monday shattered the early calm of a summer morning. A resident who lives near the shooting scene said she had heard multiple gunshots and could see the victim's body lying in a pool of blood from his second-floor window. The man, who identified himself only as JT to protect his privacy, said the victim had been left in the street for several hours while the investigation commenced. "I'll never forget the body," JT said. Another neighbor, Valerie Brinkman, had been washing dishes when she heard the gunshots. She looked out the window and saw three people who appeared to be federal agents screaming at a driver, "Do not get out of the car." Brinkman said she heard a woman yelling inside the apartment building they share. "Mia Moore, Mia Moore," Brinkman said she heard the woman scream in Spanish. "My love, my love." Others held the woman back as she attempted to run into the street toward the victim, Brinkman said. "We just know that she is a wonderful person, and we didn't want to put her in danger, too," Brinkman said through tears. Another neighbor, M. Ackerley, thought she heard an engine backfiring. Half a beat later, a succession of 6 to 7 gunshots pierced the air, she said. The 34-year-old said she rushed to the second-floor window and saw a white vehicle slowly circling the intersection as if the driver had lost control. Two plainclothes officers in green vests plus an unmarked white vehicle managed to wedge the car against the curb, Ackerley said. The targeted vehicle had stopped moving. "It was clear," Ackerley said, "he was not alive." Ackerley said it took more than 10 minutes for an ambulance to arrive and that an emergency responder was the only one that ran toward the man to attempt to save his life. Protesters took to the streets of Biddeford shortly after the shooting. Collins is embroiled in what is expected to be a close, bitterly contested re-election race following the departure of Graham Platner, a Democrat, from the campaign. Some demonstrators banged on her office doors before police arrived and blocked the entrance. Shea Stewart Booley, an influential Maine social justice writer, spoke to a crowd that had gathered at Mechanics Park. "Safety is an illusion," Stewart Booley said in a microphone. "We have seen what happened in Minnesota. We have seen what happened in Chicago. And in many of our minds, we probably thought as Mainers that would never happen here." But she added, "It happened here, in Biddeford, in our community." Community members laid flowers at the shooting site in the afternoon. Purple, pink, white, and yellow, along with a few candles. Next to the memorial, the street was still stained with something dark and red. Next to it, someone had written in chalk, "This is blood," with an accompanying message on the sidewalk that read, "Say his name." State Representative Mark Mellon, who represents Biddeford, said the incident almost felt inevitable. "You see what's been happening across the country, and that's the fear," he said. "You don't know exactly when and where it's going to happen. It happened here, and it's awful." In Mechanics Park, Judy Montoni, 74, of Biddeford, held a sign bearing the face of Renee Good, who was fatally shot by immigration agents in Minneapolis in January. "We used to do this kind of thing in the 70s, she said of the impromptu demonstration. "I didn't think it'd be back and that it'd be anything like this." As protesters walked through downtown Biddeford, others angrily voiced support for federal agents. "Ice, ice, baby," one man yelled out of a van on Main Street, raising his fist in the air at the protesters. "Get a job," another man screamed at the demonstrators. Later Monday night, Mafalo Chittum's voice was shaky as she addressed protesters. Chittum, the executive director of the Maine Immigrants' Rights Coalition, moved from Zambia to Maine in 2002. Despite her sadness, she says she was heartened to see so many people had come to speak out for Mainers who came to this country as immigrants, as she did. "Your support is felt by the immigrants who can't simply come out here," said Chittum, who is a naturalized U.S. citizen. "Thank you for reminding us why we wanted to come to the United States." And that is the end of that article. How tragic. The next one, is also from the front page. Tossed about in Medford's municipal maelstrom. Some fear City Hall becoming a den of snooping, sniping, and uncivil action. Medford, Mass. In December 2024, an unusual syringe was discovered inside a trash bin at a Department of Public Works garage. Having heard rumors that on-the-job drug use was commonplace, Mayor Brianna Lungo Cohen and other Medford officials decided to spring surprise drug tests on at least 24 public works employees. What happened next is a subject of federal litigation, part of a pattern that Lungo Cohen says is pushback against her efforts to modernize city government, but which her critics allege is a hallmark of her tenure. Acts they say are vindictive, morale-crushing, and at times, illegal. A group of public works employees described being forced, under threat of termination, to take urine drug tests and breathalyzers in a van in a parking lot of a DPW garage after the syringe was found, according to their federal lawsuit. The workers say the door of the van was left open during the test, stripping them of their privacy as they were forced to urinate into a cup. They say the technician administering the test failed to follow basic hygiene protocols, such as changing gloves. In its response to the complaint, the city denied the van door was left open and that the technician failed to change gloves. In the end, legal filings from both the workers and the city agree on one point. None of the workers tested positive for either drug or alcohol on that day. The suit is among a raft of litigation filed by current and former employees against Lungo, Cohen, and the city. In hundreds of pages of filings reviewed by the Globe, accusations range from racism and sexism directed at the city's then-top financial official to private investigators spying on a veteran firefighter as part of a city probe to the mayor allegedly targeting a veteran's agent with false accusations based on stereotypes about people suffering from PTSD. Municipal politics throughout Massachusetts can be a blood sport. But even by those sharp-elbowed standards, the bevy of complaints and lack of clarity over how much the cases cost Medford taxpayers, even city councilors are unsure of the tally, point to a uniquely divisive type of urban politics with the mayor at the center of the storm. It bothers me that we're seeing good people being hurt, said Medford City Councilor George Scapelli. We're spending so much time trying to find something wrong, you would think we were this crooked community. All that keeps coming back is that she hears rumors, and she has personal vendettas and acts on them. Lungo Cohen maintains the lawsuits and questions about legal spending from the labor unions and moderate city politicians are part of a concerted effort to get me out of office. They are angling, she told the Globe, because I hold people accountable. With a population just under 60,000, Medford has a few claims of note. Home of Tufts University, as well as the childhood home of billionaire and former New York mayor Michael Bloomberg. In the late 1980s, a mafia induction was recorded by federal agents in a house nestled in a neighborhood just off the Fellsway, a singular coup for American law enforcement. But mostly, Medford is known as a quiet middle-class bedroom community. The median household income is estimated to be just under $130,000. Excluding the school district, the city workforce has more than 400 employees. Its annual budget tops $200 million. First elected in 2019, Lungo Cohen, a 46-year-old Democrat, is in her fourth term. She said the litigation is just resistance to her attempts at breaking up a good old boys network that she claims has historically run Medford's municipal operations. The lawsuit tells a different story. Medford's veterans agent sued her, alleging Lungo Cohen's administration wrongfully leaked reports of his employment suspension to the press, which resulted in multiple news articles and public discussion in which people were told falsely that the plaintiff engaged in dangerous misconduct due to mental illness, according to his suit. The mayor, through a court filing, denied those allegations. That litigation is ongoing. Her former chief financial officer, a black woman, sued her, alleging that at a meeting of city officials, Lungo Cohen repeatedly said the city council would want to hear a budget presentation from a white man. The city, in a legal filing, denied that allegation. That case was settled last year, but it's unclear for how much, as the city has declined to provide documentation. An IT network administrator sued her, alleging he was ordered back to work unjustly after herniating a disc and then was fired illegally. That litigation is still ongoing. The city has moved to dismiss the case. Multiple employees, including building inspectors and election coordinators, school custodians, and school security officers, have sued her in separate legal efforts, alleging they were not properly paid overtime. The city denied those allegations in the various cases. Some of the litigation was filed on behalf of Teamsters Local 25, a common sparing partner for Lungo Cohen, in various legal forums. Some cases were settled, but it's unclear for how much. Local 25 isn't the only labor group to tangle with the mayor. Earlier this year, an arbitrator found a Medford firefighter, Michael Halloran, was demoted without just cause. A legal filing in that case stated the city hired a private investigator to surveil the firefighter at his home in Plymouth because officials suspected he was abusing sick leave. A lawyer for the Firefighters Union told the Globe the city now owes Halloran $167,000 thanks to the arbitration award. A separate arbitration award this year translated to $58,000 for a group of Medford firefighters who alleged they were bypassed for overtime opportunities, according to the union. The city did not respond to questions about those two arbitration cases. Clearly what she's doing is just union busting 101, said Jeremiah O'Brien, a Medford firefighter and head of the city's firefighters union. She's violating clear contractual language to make us spend the most amount of money possible so that eventually we say, you know what, we can't afford to fight this anymore. To me, that's the end goal. She has a clear grudge against the fire department. She doesn't like us. The city has used a private investigator to probe other workers, according to legal filings. In 2021, for instance, the mayor learned of a rumor that a public works foreman was allegedly involved in an illegal snow plowing scheme and ordered authorities to hire a private investigator to look into the matter, according to a filing with the state's Department of Labor Relations. An official with the Department of Labor Relations said in a legal filing, the private investigator determined the rumors about the snowplow scheme were unsubstantiated and cleared the worker of any wrongdoing. But that state official also determined the worker did not suffer any other objective harm related to the terms and conditions of his current or future employment. The mayor told the Globe her administration has really employed a private investigator to probe city workers, and she estimated the total cost of their work during her mayoral tenure to be between $20,000 to $40,000. However, her administration did not provide receipts. Back in December 2024, the DPW drug test exacerbated a morale problem within the department, according to one worker, who said employees now don't work as hard because of the treatment they endured under Lungo Cohen. We were getting herded like cattle, said the Medford Public Works employee, speaking on the condition of anonymity, because he was not clear to speak to the public and feared retaliation. Referring to the drug testing technician, he added, the guy wasn't even changing the gloves. We were completely in shock and we were humiliated. Lungo Cohen said the decision to order the test was made among five municipal leaders, but she acknowledged she was the one to make the final call. I can't have our DW employees drinking and doing drugs on the job while they're operating heavy machinery, she said. I'd rather drug test and figure out what lawsuit they're going to file. But none of the workers tested positive for either drugs or alcohol on that day, according to the legal filings. In their suit, the employees, all members of the Teamster Local 25 union, claim the drug test violated their Fourth Amendment rights, which protect against unreasonable searches, among other constitutional violations. Lungo Cohen's critics also contend there are many unanswered questions about the cost of all the litigation to the city. Everybody in Medford has been trying to get information about the suits, how much money is being spent, said Nick Gurlio, a former Medford City Council candidate who currently volunteers as a sort of liaison between City Hall and the West Medford neighborhood. Medford has not had a city solicitor since last fall, and earlier in Lungo Cohen's term, the post was also vacant for more than 2 years. She said that KP Law, a law firm in downtown Boston, serves as acting solicitor for the city. Lungo Cohen noted many municipalities use outside lawyers and pointed to a 2023 study that showed Medford's legal spending is below nearby comparable communities such as Arlington, Everett, and Somerville. That explanation has not appeased the city council. Matters came to a head at a council meeting in late June, on a cusp of a new fiscal year. The council voted to cut the city's legal department budget by more than 80%, effectively funding the department for just 2 months, giving the administration time to answer questions about the extent of its legal expenses. Really, the question has been, what did we spend last year on total legal cost, and which budgets did it come out of? Asked City Councilor Anna Callahan. Expenses for the law department itself are posted online, but it's not clear how much more the city spends on legal costs. A spokesperson said the administration does not have an up-to-date breakdown of legal expenses available. Generally, I'd say it's not transparent at all, said Gurlio, the political observer from West Medford. The public, they just want to understand what's going on. Wow. Pretty serious in Medford there. Okay, so our next article is from the Nation section of today's Globe. Judge denounces Trump's IRS lawsuit, said claim was an exercise in self-dealing. A federal judge ruled Monday that President Trump's lawsuit against the IRS was an improper exercise in self-dealing and barred him from claiming that the extraordinary tax protections he received were part of a legitimate settlement agreement. In the 56-page order, the judge, Kathleen Williams, also referred the lawyer who brought Trump's case against the IRS to the Florida bar for potential disciplinary proceedings. She added that she would forward her decision to the New York bar for its continuing investigation of the acting attorney general, Todd Blanche, who faces a Senate confirmation hearing this week. The decision by Williams, who sits in U.S. District Court in Miami, did not explicitly kill the deal that Trump had worked out with his own government to receive what amounted to amnesty from IRS investigations. But the scathing ruling exposed the negotiations between Trump's personal lawyers and senior officials at the Justice Department for what she says they were, backroom dealing that did not arise from a legitimate legal process. The nature of the suit itself and the conduct of the parties and counsel from its filing make plain that this was an attempt to use the court to provide some legitimacy to an agreement to confer immunity to people and entities affiliated with the president, the judge wrote. The ruling was the latest example of a federal judge calling out the Trump administration for twisting normal court procedures to the president's advantage. Trump has repeatedly used the criminal justice system to pursue and punish those he believes to be his enemies. But in this case, Williams wrote, he sought to use a civil legal system to benefit himself, even though the law did not allow it. Whatever may be the party's wishes, inclinations, or the dictates of their passion, she wrote, they cannot alter the state of the facts or evade the rule of law. In January, Trump sued the IRS, blaming it for the leak of his tax returns during his first term and demanding at least $10 billion in damages. But rather than taking the typical steps to defend the agency against Trump's claim, the Justice Department instead reached what it called a settlement agreement that included two remarkable provisions. The first created a $1.8 billion fund aimed at compensating allies of Trump who say they were the victims of so-called government weaponization. The prospect of Trump's administration making extensive payouts to the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021, immediately set off a political firestorm. And Blanche later said that the Justice Department would not move forward with the fund. But Blanche, Trump's former personal lawyer, had also signed a separate order granting the president, his family, and their businesses wide-ranging, unprecedented immunity from tax inquiries. He directed the IRS to stop any active audits of the Trumps and told the agency to not conduct any new investigations of tax returns they had already filed. That protection from audits, potentially very valuable for Trump, who has aggressively avoided taxes throughout his life, did not attract the same political pushback from the Republicans. Blanche has said it will remain in place. Under Williams' order, Trump and his family are prohibited from calling the audit protections a settlement in any official proceeding. But it is unclear if that will otherwise prevent Trump and the many companies affiliated with him and his family from relying on it to try to escape IRS scrutiny. An adverse ruling in just one IRS examination of Trump could have cost him more than $100 million, the New York Times has reported. Experts have doubted whether Blanche even had the authority to direct the IRS to stop audits. And Williams said his directive violated a federal law preventing the White House from controlling IRS investigations. It is also unclear whether the IRS has carried out Blanche's order, now almost 2 months ago. In her ruling, Williams took direct aim at Blanche at a sensitive moment, days before he was to appear in the Senate for his confirmation hearing as Attorney General. Yikes. Okay, and the next article, I'm going to find it in 1 second, from The World. Trump renews naval blockade as strikes surge. Vows to control strait and charge a protection fee. After another night of attacks by Iran in the United States, President Trump said Monday that he was reinstating a naval blockade on Iranian ports and would charge a fee for protecting ships going through the Strait of Hormuz. Iran, seemingly undeterred by a barrage of U.S. strikes over the past week, again vowed to avenge the death of its supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike in February and buried last week after a public procession. Tehran and Washington have effectively reverted to the state of open conflict that existed before they reached a ceasefire, which was intended to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to commercial traffic and pave the way for a permanent peace deal. In an interview with Fox News Monday, Trump said the U.S. would take control of the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran claims it controls, and would charge other wealthy nations for safeguarding passage through it. "We're going to guard it, and we're going to get paid for guarding it," he said. Trump offered no details on how such an arrangement would work. In a social media post, he said that the U.S. will be reimbursed at the rate of 20% on all cargo shipped for any and all costs necessary to do the job of providing safety and security to this very volatile section of the world. Iran, asserting its own claim to the strait, has repeatedly fired on commercial ships in the waterway, driving up global energy prices and prompting U.S. attacks on Iranian targets. Brent crude, the international benchmark, jumped to $83 a barrel Monday, up from $76 on Friday. Traffic in the strait plummeted after Iran's latest strike hit a Cypriot flag container ship over the weekend. Just 14 ships passed through the waterway Sunday in both directions, the fewest in a month, according to Kepler, a maritime data firm. Trump's plan to charge fees for protecting ships in the strait appeared to conflict with Secretary of State Marco Rubio's statement last month that no country is allowed to charge tolls or fees on an international waterway. The International Maritime Organization, which is part of the United Nations, said Monday that it had reaffirmed that passage through the strait should remain free of any tolls and charges in accordance with international law and the organization's founding treaty. Trump had initially imposed a blockade on ships entering and leaving Iranian ports in May as part of a plan to weaken Iran's economy and force the country to make concessions at the negotiating table. He then lifted the blockade last month after Iran and the United States agreed to a truce. U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. forces in the Middle East, said the military would resume enforcing the blockade Tuesday. A spokesperson for Iran's military command, Ali Bajiri Khani, warned regional leaders that any cooperation with the U.S. or logistical support for its invading military will be regarded as an act of war against Iran's sovereignty and national security. Should the conflict expand, the flames of war will engulf all countries in the region, he said in a statement published by Iran's state broadcaster. The statement was part of a surge in threats from Iranian hardliners. Earlier Monday, Khatami said that it was the right of the Iranian nation to avenge the death of Khamenei, who was buried last week after millions of people took part in a funeral procession. Some of the mourners had carried portraits depicting Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance behind crosshairs. Congress has directed Trump to end the war unless he receives congressional approval to continue it. But the White House has argued that the president is acting within his constitutional authority as commander-in-chief. Okay, that's the end of that article. Our next article, also from the World section. Macron pledges Europe will defend itself with blood. 25 leaders joined bid to support Ukraine in peace. President Emmanuel Macron of France declared Monday Europeans were ready to defend their continent with blood if necessary, as he convened more than 25 leaders for a robust show of support for Ukraine. On the eve of Bastille Day, France's national holiday, the leaders met to cement plans for a multinational force known as the Coalition of the Willing, which they would deploy in the aftermath of a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia to reinforce the Ukrainian army and stabilize the country. Setting the stage for that gathering, Macron earlier Monday gave what amounted to his farewell address to France's military. It was the last of these annual speeches by Macron before he steps down from the presidency next May, and he used it to showcase how France and Europe had come in defending itself. "The message we are sending to the world is this," Macron said. "Yes, peace is our aim. Yes, we cherish freedom and the law. And yes, we are ready to fight to defend them, always and at the cost of blood if necessary." The comments reflected a broader effort among European leaders to project strength as the United States is stepping back from its role as the guarantor of European security, leaving Europe more vulnerable to threats from a hostile Russia. Europe is still relatively underprepared for a major conflict, but it has significantly scaled up its military expenditure over the past decade, partly under pressure from President Trump. Macron emphasized the growth in France's military budget during his nearly 10 years in office, from $65 billion in 2017 to $65 billion this year. "Spending will have doubled by the time he leaves office," Macron said, given a budget increase approved by Parliament. Speaking in characteristically grand terms, Macron described strategic autonomy as this independence of analysis, in decision and in action, this freedom at heart, this ambition for our country, adding that it makes France great. It was a contrast to Macron's first year as president. That year, General Pierre de Villiers, the chief of France's general staff, the nation's highest-ranking military officer, abruptly resigned after a clash with the new president over his government's plans to cut military funding. It left a residue of bitterness between Macron and France's military commanders that took years to disappear. In convening the leaders of other countries, Macron hopes to seize on the new momentum behind Ukraine, which has scored battlefield gains against Russia and won fresh respect even from Trump. Trump recently approved licenses for Ukraine to manufacture Patriot air defense systems, something President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine had long sought. to help Ukraine accelerate the development of a homegrown air defense industry. France said Monday that it was joining eight other European countries, including Britain and Germany, to form a so-called anti-ballistic coalition. We believe the protection of Europe requires a global solution of integrated missile defense architecture to defer and defeat future missile threats. Developed through collective effort, technological openness, and trusted industrial cooperation, the members of the coalition said in a joint declaration. Anti-ballistic missiles were expected to be a key focus at the meeting, which Zelensky attended. In addition to the licenses to manufacture Patriots, France and Spain are accelerating development of a new generation of interceptors that would be deployed to Ukraine to stop a barrage of Russian ballistic missiles. European leaders have been heartened by Trump's warmer approach toward Ukraine, both at the Group of Seven leaders meeting in Evian-le-Bain, France, last month, and the NATO summit last week in Ankara, Turkey. Trump's support is viewed as critical because Europe's planned post-war force will still rely on the United States' protection against potential attacks on its troops by Russia. The coalition, which was launched by France and Britain in 2025, now comprises 37 countries, with no recent addition of Moldova and North Macedonia. And that is the end of that particular article. Okay, this next article is also from the World section. Minnesota prosecutors obtain evidence and probe into protest shooting deaths. Minnesota prosecutors have obtained key evidence in their investigations into the fatal shootings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty. The Trump administration has turned over evidence long sought by Minnesota investigators in their ongoing probe into the fatal shootings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty during pitched protests against an immigration enforcement crackdown early this year, state prosecutors said Monday. The progress came as a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent shot and killed a motorist in Maine on Monday. And Houston prosecutors complained the administration was still withholding critical information in their investigation into a fatal shooting by an ICE officer last week. Hennepin County Attorney Mary Morarity said the evidence turned over by federal investigators included previously withheld hard drives containing statements, police body camera video, and other materials in the Minnesota killings. They also turned over Good's badly damaged SUV, she said. The wonderful thing now is we have all the evidence, Moriarty said. Anytime the government is responsible in whatever way of taking the life of a community member, we need to have a full and thorough investigation. Good, the 37-year-old mother of three, was shot and killed in a vehicle while leaving an anti-immigration enforcement protest in Minneapolis on January 7. Her death and that of Pretty, a 37-year-old intensive care nurse shot and killed by federal officers just weeks later during a January 24th protest, sparked outrage across the country and calls to rein in immigration enforcement. The Minneapolis immigration crackdown, dubbed Operation Metro Surge, was billed as the largest immigration enforcement operation ever, and it ended in February after thousands of immigration and customs enforcement agents withdrew from the state. At least nine people have been killed since the Trump administration's immigration enforcement campaign last year. No one has been charged in connection with the deaths, and the federal government has suggested state prosecutors don't have jurisdiction to investigate federal officers. Lawyers for Good's family said the transfer of evidence represented an important and meaningful step towards justice and accountability. Spokespersons for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota, as well as ICE and the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees immigration enforcement, didn't immediately respond to emails seeking comment on Monday. Moriarty said local investigators have been poring over the evidence after receiving it in recent days, but declined to provide details on what prompted the federal government to turn it over. Documents recently filed in the lawsuit brought by state and local officials against Homeland Security and Justice Departments, however, suggest the breakthrough came after federal officials asked the state in June for evidence gathered in the investigation of ICE agent Kristen Castro. Castro, 52, was charged with assault and falsely reporting a crime in connection with the January 14th non-fatal shooting of Julio Cesar Sosa Celis in Minneapolis. Prosecutors say Castro filed through a home's front door and shot Sosa Celis in the thigh while in pursuit of another man. State and local prosecutors said they would provide evidence in Castro's case as soon as the federal government agreed to share its evidence in the shootings of Pretty and Good. Minnesota officials last month sued the administration for access to evidence for investigations into the three shootings. "We are willing to share evidence with you if the exchange is reciprocal," Minnesota Bureau of Crime Apprehension Superintendent Drew Evidence wrote in a legal filing to federal officials. The pressure may have increased on June 18th when Moriarty and Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison amended their lawsuit against the federal government to add details about the federal government's refusal to share evidence collected in the fatal shootings. Wow. Okay. Our next article is from the Metro section of today's Globe. Auditor says housing program reeks of fraud. Wow, it's getting pretty rough today. Probe flags developers' hidden ties to mass housing official. State Auditor Diane DeZiglio said a state program aimed at boosting affordable housing should undergo an independent government investigation following a recent Globe Spotlight team investigation that found evidence of fraud and conflict of interest. DeZiglio, who said the reporting raised concerns of possible criminal conduct, said her office may conduct its own inquiry into the program, which awarded $1.4 million to two developers who had hidden connections to the state official handing out the money. But she first wants to ensure her auditors would not be getting in the way of any other civil or criminal investigation. DeZiglio said she would be watching closely for signs of another probe. She also questioned the decision by Mass Housing, the quasi-state agency that oversaw the grant giveaway, to hire the Boston-based Mintz Law Firm to review the Spotlight team's findings about the agency's Gateway Housing Rehabilitation Program. Mass Housing's actions seem performative at best, and more about protecting the institution rather than the public, she said, adding that the program highlighted by the Globe reeks of fraud and corruption. Whether another investigation has been or will be launched is unclear. Christina Di Iorio Sterling, a spokeswoman for U.S. Attorney Leah B. Foley, said Foley's office does not confirm or deny investigations. A spokesperson for Governor Maura Healey, who appointed six of Mass Housing's nine board members, declined to comment and deferred questions to the agency. A spokesperson for the State Inspector General's office also declined to comment. A Mass Housing representative referred the Globe to a previous statement announcing the internal inquiry and said the agency had no additional comment. The Spotlight report revealed that Mass Housing executive Tony Richards II awarded the bulk of the $2.4 million available in the Gateway Housing Rehab Program to developers Gary Acqua and Reginald Woods just months after the duo sold Richards a house in West Roxbury. Records show Richards purchased a home for $204,000 less than the original list price. Richards, a former aide to Governor Charlie Baker, who serves as vice chair of an advisory council created by Healey, failed to disclose his relationship with the developers and when he doled out the grants, a likely violation of state ethics laws. Mass Housing officials initially told the Globe that Richards wasn't aware the grants were going to the same men who sold him his house. Yeah, right. They said he alerted his bosses to the conflict when he realized it about a year later. But emails reviewed by the Globe Spotlight team showed Richards interacting with Acqua and Woods in the months before and after the home purchase. Mass Housing officials have acknowledged the contradiction, but have not said whether they believe Richards lied to them. The developers' work on properties in Pittsfield and Worcester had come under scrutiny from Mass Housing officials in 2024 After inspections revealed that the repairs had been poorly done, or in some cases not done at all. The agency asked the developers to make several fixes and warned them they might no longer be eligible for grants. But the Globe found Aqua and Wood submitted fake invoices bearing the names of at least 9 contractors who told the Globe they never did the work attributed to them. Apparent fraud that Mass Housing failed to detect when it paid the bills. Following questions from the Spotlight team, the agency announced an internal investigation by the Mintz firm into the Gateway Cities program and others under Richard's purview. Agency officials have declined to offer a timeline for when the review will be complete. Lawyers from the Mintz firm have already begun interviewing Mass Housing employees at the agency's Beacon Hill offices. The Globe has repeatedly sought comment from Aqua, Woods, Richards, and Richards' attorney. To date, none have responded. Richards remains employed at Mass Housing, where he earns a salary of $255,000 as Vice President of Strategic Community Investments. A spokesperson for the agency said the oversight of grants in his department has been taken over by the legal department while the outside review is underway. Aqua, meanwhile, resigned from the board of the Community Economic Development Assistance Corporation when the Globe began asking questions about his dealings with Mass Housing. CDAC is a quasi-state nonprofit housing agency whose members are appointed by the governor. Healy declined to comment on whether she will keep Richards as vice chair of her advisory council on Black empowerment, a position she named him to shortly after she took office. The Globe's findings alarmed Representative Rodney Elliott, a Lowell Democrat and a sponsor of pending legislation that would reshape the board at Mass Housing and trigger a review of the agency's spending of public money on affordable and low-income housing in the Gateway Cities. Elliott filed his bill before the Spotlight team published its findings, but said the Globe report highlights an urgent need for more oversight of the processes at Mass Housing. A full audit is required of all programs, he said. The more open, the more transparent the programs are, the better. Mintz, the firm conducting the review for Mass Housing, has its own longstanding connections with Mass Housing. Colin McNeese, the agency's chief legal and operating officer, worked at Mintz for 11 years before joining Mass Housing in 2019. Mintz has also served as a bond counsel for the agency's multifamily housing programs for more than 30 years, according to the firm's website. Mintz helped the agency issue more than $1.3 billion in bonds over the last 2 decades. For the Mintz audit to have real value, Dees Oglio said it's important to be truly independent and open to public inspection, not subject to attorney-client privilege. Citing as an example of the latter, the report that Baker administration commissioned on the mismanagement at the Holyoke Soldiers Home that led to 76 deaths amid the pandemic. In that case, Baker's office was the client of the firm of lawyer Mark Perlstein, raising questions about whether Perlstein was working for the governor or the public. The Globe has requested a copy of Mass Housing contract of letter engagement with Mintz. But has yet to receive it. A spokesperson for the agency could not provide information about the cost of the contract, the timeline, or whether any of the firm's findings would be privileged. Well, another scam here in the Boston area. Okay, and now we're going to go to the business section of today's Globe. Once I get there in 1 second. New federal housing law could reshape mass market. Seeks to improve public developments, bolster construction. At long last, a federal bill aimed at curbing the nation's housing affordability problem became law Saturday. After a 10-day clock for President Trump to sign or veto the legislation expired at the end of the day Friday. The bill, a bipartisan package, co-sponsored by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren and South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, was a welcome intervention from the federal government, especially in coastal states like Massachusetts, where sky-high housing costs have become an existential issue. The legislation is wide-ranging, seeking to boost construction, upgrade ailing public housing, lower the cost of manufactured housing, and limit the influence of corporations in the housing market, among other reforms. And while some advocates have praised the legislation, it mostly offers piecemeal changes as opposed to wholesale reforms. Here are four of the biggest changes and what they could mean in Massachusetts. Incentivizing local housing production and punishing cities that don't build. Perhaps the bill's most notable provisions are ones that push local governments to permit more housing. The federal government's first big swing at boosting housing production on the local level in decades. It creates several incentive programs, including a new $200 million annual grant fund for communities that demonstrate measurable increases in housing supply. Another grant program would provide funds to help local governments create pre-reviewed templates for certain standard housing types, like duplexes and townhomes, easing the permitting process. The bill also ties a small portion of local community development block grant funding, a popular federal source of affordable housing funding, to housing production. Communities that don't build enough would lose 10% of their annual CDBG funding, with that money going instead to cities that build more. Boston received around $17 million in CDBG funds in the 2024 fiscal year. In a statement, Andrew McCullough, chief housing economist at the Pioneer Institute, celebrated the housing production provisions, calling the bill the most comprehensive, supply-focused federal housing legislation in decades. Those changes are likely to provide a small boost for housing production in Massachusetts, though most communities likely will see little impact because the incentive programs are relatively small and only a handful of municipalities utilize CDBG funds. Easing public housing repairs. Another notable provision will boost efforts to repair federally funded low-income housing. Public housing has been chronically underfunded on both the state and federal levels for decades. After building a massive portfolio of government-funded homes for low-income people between the 1940s and 60s, the federal government now offers just limited funding that has left many buildings in a state of chronic disrepair. The bill expands the Department of Housing and Urban Development's Rental Assistance Demonstration Program, which allows housing authorities to convert public housing subsidies to Section 8 vouchers and utilize loans and grants to finance big renovations of existing buildings. The number of units that can be transitioned under the program is capped, and the federal bill will lift up that cap by 100,000 nationwide, allowing more units to be repaired. Public housing authorities in Massachusetts have increasingly used the program to rehabilitate ailing buildings, including a 100-unit high-rise in Brookline that was renovated through the program in 2023. The state has around 33,000 federally funded public housing units and a much larger state funding portfolio that is also in poor condition. And that is the end of the reading of the Boston Globe from the Talking Information. This is Liza, and we'll see you next week.